Blog Talk Radio.
Devote ourselves to the presentation of anarchism as a philosophy which aims at the emancipation, economic, social, political, and spiritual of the human race.
Those who share in the golden dedication towards liberation of the human race, we present to you
the Anthologian Slash Anarchia.
Your favorite anarchist radio show with the radical analysis of the news, reports from the front lines of the struggle, and a healthy reminder of what is freedom in this land of confusion. Join us Monday through Friday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time, where you can call in to ask questions, tip us off to an action in your area, or just tell us what's on your mind. Let's make the world smash. Be known.
Hello everyone, once again to the Authority Smashing Hour, your daily anarchist radio show on the internet with your hosts Buddha Jam and Mr. 1001 Nights. And I want to hope that everyone had a nice holidays, because I know you did, Buddha Jam, didn't you? Had a good time?
Yeah, we had a really good time, definitely. How about you? How was your New Year's?
Oh, except for this cold, wonderful. Yeah.
Man, I got like the workings of a cold coming on, I think. I had like a little bit of a sore throat this morning, but I feel pretty good, so hopefully I'll fight it off.
You know, I think that's sort of a little reminder to us of, you know, that we don't appreciate what we have till we lose it. And very often when we lose our health, when we lose stuff that we take for granted, we can look at our lives and say, you know, I better appreciate what I have. I better appreciate and value what I have right now, because you know, and also have compassion for those who have lost their health, have lost their well-being, and a lot of people in our society are not functioning at top level,
right,
so to speak. So
I just saw a pretty scary statistic: 1 in 50 people. We mentioned earlier on the show. Other shows that 1 in 4 adults is on food stamps. I just saw another startling statistic said 1 in 50 Americans are living on food stamps alone. They don't have any other kind of cash coming in, food. So and people do, you know, bargain their food stamps for some cash. So, you know, they'll buy you something and then you give them cash. So I'm sure, you know, there's some way that they're probably getting some kind of money, but the primary means of survival right now is simply food stamps.
Also, I talked to a guy, a homeless friend of mine who doesn't look homeless at all, but he hangs out at Borders a lot. But we talk about how the amount that they give you for food stamps hasn't changed in like a hell of a long time, like 10, 20 years. Like you get like, I think it's $130 a month or something for food, which, you know, mm-hmm. if you just eat ramen noodles, that'll be enough probably, but not if you want to, you know, buy anything. And I mean, if you go to a place like Whole Foods or something, you know, I have a friend of mine who always buys food there, and it's like you go there, buy a few vegetables. I mean, she buys a few vegetables, a few things here and there. You're already stuck with $100 bill. You know, it's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
So
money doesn't go very far. Yeah, it's a shame the amount of money that we put into that. And it, one of the saddest things, I think, there's this really deep-seated hatred of the poor in this country in a lot of ways, and you often see it at times now. And that's why I always try to stress these statistics. I mean, you know, when you tell people 1 in 4 Americans are on food stamps, you can't just say, oh, it's just the lazy deadbeats. Not that I ever think that, but, you know, this is a common theme. So it's really important to stress these facts to people that you know, it's everybody. I mean, you know, 1 in 50 Americans is just living on food stamps alone. 1 in 4 Americans, or I'm sorry, it's 1 in 6 Americans, it's 1 in 4 children. On food stamps. These are startling statistics, and it gets worse as you know, we're in a rather privileged country, as sad as that may sound. I think the latest statistics, I mean, there's just a tsunami of hunger going on right now around the world due to this economic crisis, and they're saying there's probably 1 billion people right now battling with malnutrition. I mean, it's, you know, really, that's epic, billion people. And this is in a planet with enough food for everybody. This is a severe, you know, just an illustration of how poorly capitalism works.
Right.
You know,
and
what's economics? It's how do you get, you know, products and goods to people.
And that is,
you know,
the context.
You know, it's basic economics.
And that is the context in which we have to see Barack Obama's claims about, you know, protecting the American people. He's saying he's spending trillions of dollars in wars because he wants to protect the American people against a terrorist attack, which may kill, you know, a few hundred or a few thousand people. That's what he claims, even though it's actually increasing the threat of terrorism, as has been pointed out even by the CIA itself. But let's suppose that it was true. Let's suppose that he really was trying to protect us against terrorism. Isn't this a much worse form of terrorism when people are you know, dying at the workplace, don't have enough food to eat? I mean, that's going to kill many more people, and you know.
Well, yeah, not only will it kill more people, not only does it kill more people, but think of how outraged those people must be. I mean, you know, what we typically think of as terrorism in this country is, you know, we don't think of when we're dropping bombs on, you know, wedding parties and whatnot, because there are bombs and our fighter jets. But you know, we typically think of these desperate individuals. Maybe like this recent guy tried to blow up his, you know, underwear or whatever. And how desperate, if you've got a billion people who are desperate just for food, how basic is that? You know, food.
It's
in
like
a world where there's plenty of food for everybody, isn't that, I mean, you know, not only are a lot of people going to die necessarily, but it's going to spawn a lot of angry people, you
it's
know,
like,
who are going to lash out in ways that may not be constructive.
It's like we never got past level one. It's sort of like if let's say you were a total beginner, like a total ignoramus as far as to creating a society, and you ask somebody, hey, you know, let's create a society. What are the first things they need to have? Well, if you have an IQ above room temperature, you would say, okay, you need food, you need water, you need shelter. And then, you know, somebody may ask you, hey, what about libraries? What about this? What about that? You may not know about that, but you at least would know about those sort of essential things, right? Now, it seems that capitalism hasn't even gotten past that, you know, level one, that very basic level of what even the most, you know, sort of ignorant person in the world would tell you that it's necessary to have a society.
Right. Well, you know, that's the problem with, you know, this capitalism. The right to live isn't a right. You know, the right to this earth and its resources and its abundance. Under capitalism, we don't have a right to live. The only right we have is to be able to rent ourselves to some boss. And if we can exercise that right and find someone willing to rent us, and you know, meek out some meager existence under the capitalist system, those are the rights we have. Anything else is tampering with the sacredness of the market, you know, on and on. And it's sickening.
You know that girl, the Julia, who's really into the Palestinian cause. She pointed out a video where you had some Republican lobbyists, you know, basically kids that were being trained into becoming lobbyists, and they were fundamentalists, right? And these kids, they went, you know, they were all dressed up in suits and ties, and they went to a government building and basically handed out some sort of leaflet talking about how they were against Social Security and against, you know, just all these welfare measures. And this guy actually said something that made sense. He said, look, the reason why I oppose this is because the Bible says that the earth belongs to God, not to the state. Right? Now, see, just think about this. The Bible belongs to God. What if he thought not to the capitalists? The you know, and that's basically the idea behind a lot of these Christian anarchists. They say, yeah, the Bible belongs to, the earth belongs to God, which means this... So therefore, we should share the earth. It doesn't belong to capitalists, to the state, to anybody. Although, of course, you could point out, you know, the state at least allows us to have some say in this particular predicament we're in which the corporations have control over pretty much every aspect of our economic life. But you know, it's just funny, 'cause you could have that sort of double think where you know, it was common sense to sort of say, hey, you know, God, it belongs to God, you know. I mean, whether or not you believe in God, it's a different. But he couldn't actually come to the conclusion that the same thing applies to these corporations, these capitalists.
Yeah, that's it sounds like an interesting video. It's sad to see. I mean, we've seen that with the YouTube user, How the World Works. He kind of just fell out of college, and now he's in that think tank apparatus, and they're shipping him around to speak to younger college kids. And you know, I just saw he had a speech at some local college where he was helping them to avoid the leftist indoctrination. And you know, the Republican youth had invited him to the school or something. And yeah, a lot of this is going on. Definitely. Heritage Foundation, they pump a lot of money into this, and they're not, you know, they're not.
I wanted to ask you. You're trying to tell me that that I'm getting a little static here. Do you hear static noises here, or no? Is it
Yeah, I
okay now?
wasn't sure if I was breaking in and out or if you were. I wasn't sure, so maybe someone else can tell us.
Is it okay
Do I
now?
sound clear to you?
You sound clear to me. Hey, Charnshi, can you?
Yeah, you sound better now.
All right. Okay. Good. Okay, so yeah, I mean it's a constant battle, and let's not be fooled, you know, about what they call leftist indoctrination. It's basically a doctrine that aims to protect capitalism from itself. I mean, now you have people like the Soros Foundation. They're trying to push a more Kantian sort of approach because, you know, it works. You know, what I think the problem was that, you know, I try to highlight this and. The video that I did, Golden Rule, is that, you know, the economy was growing pretty fast after Second World War, and you know the wages were sort of kept up with the growth of the economy. So, you know, the workers got too comfortable, started forming unions and so on, and they gained too much power, and that contributed to the revolt of the 60s. And so the capitalists realize, hey, you know, we can make more profit. We can feel less threatened if we switch to a more finance led economy. I don't know if that was is the whole story, but I think it's definitely a factor. And now you know the export the
Well,
jobs
yeah, the
to
change in
China.
technologies too that allowed that to come to fruition too. It wasn't just that the capitalists themselves came to some, you know, decided, oh, you know, this would be a better way to manage the economy. You know,
No,
the rise and, you know,
it's a
yeah.
self-correcting system. So if you see profit is more you know is you can pursue profit through some other avenue of action, I think that they tend to do that. And you know the problem was that if you know send all the jobs to China and you know people don't have money to buy the stuff here, then you're stuck with another problem. So you know capitalism needs regulation to save itself, and that's something Roosevelt realized, and that's something that the people that How the World Works is accusing of being a leftist indoctrinators. That's all they're trying to do, simply to bring about some regulation to capitalism to save capitalism from itself. Most of these people are not, you know, anarchists. They're not against the. They're not in favor of overthrowing capitalism in the state. But for him, that's enough for to feel threatened. These regulations are for him
Right.
anti-capitalist.
I think we are seeing positive signs, though. I mean, we've talked, you know, at length about about the Nobel Prize winner in economics this year, Elinor Nordstrom, and her work validating that commons have been successfully managed. I was just reading a story earlier today about the Chicago School and how they're kind of circling the drain. Their ideas of efficient markets are all but, you know, a religious faith at this point. I was pointing to a story where one of the prominent thinkers of the Chicago School declared that the only reason we had a crash was because the president was talking about the markets might crash. Like he here's a senior economic and you know analyst for the Chicago School saying that the president all by himself caused this entire thing just by saying that it was a possible outcome that the markets might fail, you know. And so the guy, the Soros reading is like, this is where they're at intellectually, is they don't have anything to say. The idea that markets are efficient is gone. The idea that commons can't be successfully organized, you know, decentrally organized, you know, very much based on anarchist principles, that's been proven empirically. You know, all the ideas, and not to mention the fact that they've had plenty of chances to implement their ideas around the world, and they've met with nothing but failure, time and time again.
And
And so, I think that, you know, in this latest economic crisis, I mean, they're really just kind of on, you know, running on fumes at this point. So I think, you know, that's heartening. We have to take this initiative and take this momentum and run with it.
I may mention that also what they call the market economy and so on has greatly benefited from state intervention for a long time, starting with military industrial complex, you know, creation of things like computers, container ships, CDs, etc., etc. So they've always had the help of the state, not only to protect their property, obviously, since the police will obviously come to the aid of the capitalist if the workers try to take over the factories, but to subsidize R&D. Research and development through the taxpayer, etc., etc. So it's not like their capitalism. I mean, if you told me that, say, in the 19th century, you had deindustrialized America that followed the free market rules, and that, you know, we found ourselves in, you know, in our predicament, then you at least you would have you could say, hey, it was pure free market all along. But it really wasn't. In fact, if we had had free market, as Chomsky has pointed out, right now we would be exporting fish and fur because we would not have pursued a policy of industrialization because our comparative advantage back then for the United States was, you know, exporting what was being produced in the land, which was fish and fur. So, but
I'd be
only
trading beaver pelts right now, right?
right, and so what happened was that the founding fathers, Alexander Hamilton, he talked about defending what he called infant industry, that is defending protecting American industry from foreign imports. So he would impose tariffs, impose all these measures to allow industry to develop. And then when it became competitive, then you had an opening up of the market. But
Right.
the problem
And
with the,
that's been,
yeah, go ahead.
yeah, and that's been you know, confirmed by, you know, even more recent economists like Joseph Stiglitz, who again is also a Nobel Prize winner in economics. And you know, he writes in his book Globalization and Its Discontents. He shows how, you know, the former states of the Soviet Union, Russia, for example, followed IMF, you know, guidelines to the letter, and were met with nothing but disaster. China, on the other hand, did like what you're saying, protected infant, you know, industries, and let them grow before they, you know, expose them to market, you know, pressures.
Right.
And that's the only way. I mean, that's within a market-based system. We're, you know, we want to abolish markets altogether. But the idea that markets—that's what I'm getting at, though. Even within the capitalist framework, the idea that markets are efficient, that markets will just regulate themselves. A lot of these ideas, even someone like Alan Greenspan, who is an Ayn Rand devotee, totally at least claims to believe in all this free market nonsense. Even he's admitted that he's had a lapse in his faith, and you know, which is telling in and of itself, a lapse of faith. Wait a minute, wait a minute. You're supposed to be like a scientist, right? Wasn't economics supposed to be a science? And he's like, you know, it's a lapse in faith. That's what it is. It's become religious dogma. This whole nonsense about free markets is nothing but religious dogma.
Well, since we're in the subject of economics, I may point out that a lot of these theories of modern economics developed as a sort of reaction to the very threatening theories that were put forth by people like Marx and Proudhon, because they were focusing on production. They were focusing on how the workers were being exploited, how the capitalist takes through non-labor income, he extracts labor power and profit from the workers. And so on. So they were focusing on that process of exploitation. Now, the modern economists said, shit, we got to do something about this. So what they did is that they switched the focus from production to basically trading. I give you tomatoes, you give me potatoes, and basically, like, everything is subjective. Well, the subjective is, and it's what's called the subjective theory of economics. So, it just everything is sort of an exchange in the market. You abstract away from the conditions of production, and you focus on exchanges, on subjective evaluations, and they even have things that have been totally refuted by economists, by neo-Keynesian economists, like someone who I interviewed in this program earlier last year. His name is Steve Keen, and he's proven that some of the basic things you're taught in economic school, like the indifference curves, which basically show you how there's a combination, but of say ice cream and potatoes that will give you the sort of ideal amount of stuff you want to buy, just and they have this curve called the indifference curve. I mean, all that stuff is total nonsense. That he's explained it very, very, very clearly. And but the problem is that the root cause of the focus on subjective evaluations was to counter the very, very popular notion of Marxian and anarchist economics, which pointed out the exploitation of the workers at the workplace.
Right, yeah, and the labor theory of value. one of the best examples I love, I've heard market, it's actually on the what is it, anarcho-capitalist and FAQ. They actually have an FAQ. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but to refute the labor theory of value, they imagine a bunch of workers spending all day making mud pies. Now they've mixed their labor with the mud all day long. So if the labor theory of value is true, well, those mud pies would be worth a lot of money at the end of the day. But nobody's buying mud pies. Isn't that weird?
Well,
What a stellar, sophisticated
right.
argument.
Marx and
And again, of
Proudhon
course, it
didn't
has no
see
bearing
that.
to
Marx and Proudhon missed that. Can you believe that these supposedly outstanding minds missed that? No, I mean the answer to that is obvious. For something to have something must have exchange value in order to have in order to be able to be sold. So you can create whatever you can dig a hole in the ground, right? And then fill it up again. Nobody's going to pay you for that because it's not socially useful, right? So we understand that. But the it's not so much about it's not so much about prices, because there's other elements that enter into prices. Even though I think that the labor theory value does say that in the long term the prices tend to show the contribution of labor. But without getting, I mean, I think
Right.
that labor theory value has
Yeah.
some strength to it. What Steve Keen actually said against it, labor theory of value, he said that, like, for example, the contribution of a machine to production is greater than the like the wearing out of the machine. So the machine may get worn out at a certain rate. Say the machine gets worn out in like 2 years, right? So the contribution of production of the
Yeah.
machine. So in other words, that the materials you use for production also contribute to how much you produce and so on, which contributes to the profit of the capitalist. So labor, I mean, labor is not the only thing that contributes to production in that sense,
No, well, yeah, but
because
that,
if you use better
yeah, and Mark
materials.
certainly didn't argue that.
You, if you use better materials, you're gonna get better results, more profit for the capitalist. But who's doing the labor? It comes down to what do we value as having, as really being worthy of labor value. I mean, does the work of the worker, do we value that more than non-labor income, I mean the non-labor of the
I mean,
capitalist.
it was, you know, even if you're, you know, you're talking about like the input of the machinery or the technology, but again, all of that is a product of workers. You know, I mean, capitalists are not creating the technology that we all enjoy. You know, it wasn't capitalists that created the internet or the computer, or like we were just saying, you know, containerization or automation or any of these things. These were the result of a massive cooperative effort, subsidized and paid for by the state through public funding, right? So, I mean, you know, but again, it's, you know, if you talk about a machine, that machine's not made by some capitalist. You know, Bill Gates doesn't make anything. So, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, all these things are the result of what workers have done. So, you know, I don't know.
Right. I mean,
I get what you're saying, though.
Yeah, I mean, the thing, if you want to quantify, I mean, because Steve Keen is into this the business of quantifying, you know, where profit comes from and stuff. And obviously, if you have better materials, like if I'm digging something with a metal and you're digging it with wood, we may both, yeah, you know, employ the same effort, and I may do a better job because I have better materials. Now, if you're trying to evaluate in humanistic terms, we're both doing the same effort, and a society that tries to remunerate people fairly would take those factors into consideration, and that's what our economy doesn't do. Our economy is based on bargaining power. How much can you extract from the capitalist? How much can the capitalist extract from you? And when people go ahead.
Just in your example, I mean, what comes to mind is, you know, say, you know, you're, you know, doing your thing with the metal and I'm using some other material. In capitalism, you wouldn't share that information with me because it gives you a competitive advantage, right?
Right.
But how
right.
inefficient is that? So in capitalism, you know, we have, I think it's 9 out of 10 businesses fail within 2 years. You know, and that's because a lot of it is information. The right information is so hard to come by. What businesses are needed? I mean, people just take stabs in the dark. They do all their research. They don't know. They don't have the information. And because information is hoarded, monopolized, it's very hard to come by unless you have, you know. So, I mean, in any decent economic system, you would want to share that information because you would want to limit. And hopefully avoid people wasting the time and resources of, you know, using that wrong material or digging in the wrong spot or whatever it may be, wasting everybody's time.
Right.
You know? And that's what capitalism doesn't do.
That's a competitive system.
You know, I mean, look at the housing market, 18 million vacant homes. Think about that. That was 18 million homes that were unnecessarily built in this market system. That's crazy. That's a lot of unnecessary work that was done, right? All those men and women that built those homes, cleaned them, did everything to get them ready for someone to move in, there's no customer. There's no consumer for them. All those people could have sat at home that whole time, not went out there and waste, you know, sweated their asses off building those homes, you know, in this market system. But this market system, you know, that information isn't known. The people at Goldman Sachs knew it. If you look into it, they bet on the housing crash. They knew it was coming. You know, so, I mean, the information's out there. It's not like all segments of this economy don't know what's going on. But they, you know, they don't share it. Because you're not – why would you share it? Because you're going to sell that big bundle of mortgages that are worth nothing. You're going to sell them to some other sap and tell them, oh, yeah, they're AAA rated. They're awesome. You know, go ahead.
And that's the inherent flaw. Yeah, of any competitive system. When you live in a competitive economic system, it's not to your advantage to share information. You want to withhold it from your opponent, and that creates all kinds of problems. So anyway, we are at the half-hour mark, and Charity's telling me that my sound is going in and out, so hopefully I can fix that after the break. The number you can call in if you want to ask any questions, make any comments, is 646-716-8106. Once again, 646-716-8106. So you can play a song if you want, Dave, and then come back, answer some questions, and talk about today in anarchist history.
Yeah, let's do it. You have to just pull something out of your hat. I don't I can't get on the website right now for some reason,
Oh, you
so.
can't. All right. So we're gonna play some Muse here. So Resistance by Muse. Be back in a minute. Was Resistance by Muse, and we're back on the Authority Smashing Hour, your daily anarchist radio show on the internet. And hopefully, I fix my sound issues because I keep being told that I'm coming in and out of the queue here. So, do you hear me, David?
Yeah, I hear you. I'm sorry. I would have said something. I'm never sure if that's you or it's just I was having some browser issues, so I didn't know if that was on my end. I would have said something. You sound fine now. What was the fix that you did?
I didn't do anything. I just sort of messed around with my mic. I don't know if that actually worked or not. But I want to remind
Sound
caller,
better.
you can call 646-716-8106. And I guess we can talk a little bit about that article you sent me, Buddha Jam, about China and the United States. What drew your attention about that article?
Well, I mean, it just highlights something I've said again and again. Like you asked me in the last show, I think we were talking, what would I want to do, as a carpenter? And the first thing that comes to mind is rebuild our infrastructure. This country, it's embarrassing. And this article basically comparing, two approaches to empire building, in a sense. And China is doing that by focusing on, its infrastructure. One of the things it points out, it's building this high-speed rail system where people will be able to travel, I think it's a distance of 1,100 kilometers in about 3 hours. And they point out that in the United States, you can't even get from New York to Boston by train in 3 hours. I mean, we have a dilapidated, rail system, our bridges, you name it. Our infrastructure is in the dumps. And you read this article and you see how it's not to, China's not a utopia. But again, it's that guns and butter argument. We're spending trillions of dollars waging these wars in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen now, Iraq. I mean, I'm sure the list is going to grow. Iran's going to be on the list eventually. And, in China, instead of doing that, like it points out, as we're spending, billions of dollars bombing wedding parties in China, the Chinese are actually the ones, building the vases and the dinnerware that they're using at these dinner parties. And, again, it's not to paint China some utopia, but for us as activists, it's a really stark reminder of something Eisenhower warned of with the military-industrial complex. Every dollar we spend on bombs is a dollar we're not spending on education or healthcare, housing the homeless. I mean, that money, it's going to get spent. As anarchists, some idealists like, oppose the state, smash the state. Hey, they're spending that money. Let's direct it in a more humane way. Let's bring these troops home from around the world. Let's end this, military empire that we have, and start rebuilding this country in a meaningful way.
Well, the question that came to my mind as I was reading that article is, how does this fit in within the dynamics of global capitalism? That is, the dynamics that are required to make global capitalism run efficiently. And obviously, somebody needs to be producing this stuff. And since we're in a financial-led sort of economy, somebody is going to be doing the investing and the gambling. And we know that American investors have made a killing in China. They have a lot of investment in China, and of course industries here rely enormously on labor, on Chinese labor. If you look at almost any product you get in the store, it is going to say made in China. So
it's unbelievable, right? Everything you buy is
They produce so much. I mean, I remember that I had this conversation with Charnchi a few months ago, and I asked him sort of out of, because he's Chinese American, and I said, how many trillions of dollars has the Chinese working class been stolen? How much have they been exploited off? And he said, you can't even quantify it. I mean, we're talking about these people working like dogs for pennies. And so, so in the sort of scheme of global capitalism, the U.S. has become more of a less of a productive industrialized nation and more of an investor nation, more of a finance-led economy. And China is doing all the producing, the industrializing. Now, at the end of the day, unfortunately, this is also going to be divided across class lines. So the Chinese capitalist class and the American capitalist class are probably going to end up doing pretty well because they still got the reins over the power of the state. I mean, look at the bailout. Even though they failed, they still got the money that they needed to stay rich, and they did. So at the end of the day, it's the workers both in China and the United States who are going to get screwed unless we can unionize, pass regulations, and union, right. and ultimately, obviously, overthrow capitalism in the long term.
And the Chinese workers, to their credit, are doing that. They're organizing. They are having wildcat strikes, if anybody's following the labor movement in China. It is impressive. The workers there are not, just standing around waiting for someone to save them. So that is going on. My interest in this story was simply the idea that, wow, you just wonder what we could be doing. We've spent so much money on the military in the last 50, 60 years. It just boggles the mind. You think, wow, what if that $15, $20 trillion had been spent on our nation's infrastructure, on schools and hospitals and educating people and spreading that wealth around the world. You just wonder, what a different world we might live in. And it'd still be within a global capitalist system, but it could, it could, I mean, even within this global capitalist system, there's, room for horrible and better. we're living proof of that right now as we live through this crisis. But it's just interesting to see how the capitalist class in China is dealing with these things.
I guess ultimately we also want to ask ourselves, can we implement not only a local based anti-capitalist strategy, but also an international strategy? I mean, that's why most True leftist organizations and coalitions were called internationals, you know, because you had an international coalition of people who were cooperating in the improvement of the working class and the overthrow of capitalism. And ultimately, I mean, what we call corporate globalization has been a process whereby the capitalists can enforce the global rule via via their control over a globalized capitalist world. So we have to counter that with international ties, and so we have to take advantage of all the means of communication and all the means of contacts we have with other peoples in other countries to do that. So, but of course, you know, at the local level, that's where we start, and then we build from there. Yeah.
Right. Right.
So anyway,
hey,
go ahead.
Go ahead.
No,
I was just gonna mention
what?
Real quick, we have a little bit of time. I wanted to mention something. We had our local branch meeting for the Industrial Workers of the World yesterday, and in an earlier show, I mentioned the baristas at a Starbucks in Fort Worth, Texas, had shut down, went public, with the union. And we got a report back from a fellow barista here, one of the leading organizers of the Starbucks Workers Campaign here in New York City. And it was pretty inspiring. What she came back and told us, she was a part of this, was down there when it was going on, and pretty inspiring stuff. The people who were behind this action in Starbucks they're all women. Working class women trying to get by in a Starbucks job. She said, and these are some really poor folk, no internet access, like press releases and stuff. They had to find connections outside of the area to like get these things on the internet to get the press involved. The way they started it, pretty cool. Someone drove their car around. This is a Starbucks where the main source of revenue apparently is through the drive-through, and one of the workers drove their car around to the drive-through, parked it, and I think and they put a sign. I wish I could remember what she said. The sign said something like "Baristas deserve respect" or something like that, and just left the car there. And they were able to shut down the drive-through for a half an hour, I guess. They went public with their demands, to be recognized within the union. Some really cool stuff. And again, this is, I just wish people could understand. I mean, Starbucks is a corporation, a multinational corporation that employs, I think it's a couple hundred thousand people around the world right now. And you're talking about a handful of people at this Starbucks in Fort Worth, Texas, doing what it needs to be done, organizing amongst themselves, reaching out to fellow union members in the IWW, and, standing up for their rights. And it's inspiring. It's a testament. It's a lesson for all of us that this it can be done. Very often we look at things and we just go, what can you do? We sigh and just despair, and we think nothing can be done. But, if you look around you, there are inspiring examples all over. And the action of Fort Worth, Texas is certainly something to look into. If you guys check it out, don't give up. I mean, this is not the time to give up. And the ladies at the Starbucks in Fort Worth, Texas, are certainly testament to that. Apparently, the Teamsters invited these women to a dinner they were having to be, kind of share in their triumph. They became, everybody in town knew what was going on. They started going to other Starbucks in the area. People knew them immediately from the press coverage they were getting, and everybody wanted to know more. And the great thing about it, now this is something that had been going on internally within IWW circles for some time, and we know from all the Starbucks cases that have been, won by the IWW, that Starbucks spends a lot of time spying on its employees. And it's pretty clear that they were completely in the dark about this. They did not know. So again, a good victory for the workers, being able to keep management in the dark until they decided,
I may
to
remind
let Starbucks know what's going on.
I may remind listeners that Starbucks has other branches that are not called Starbucks, like say Seattle's Coffee, that's owned by Starbucks as well. So, for example, if you go to here in San Francisco, you go to Union Square, they have a Borders bookstore. You go upstairs, and the Starbucks and the Seattle's Coffee is owned by Starbucks, and they report the same sort of harassment. That they're looking, they're spying on you the whole time. Make sure you don't eat any pastries. Make sure you do what they want you to do. So it's pretty tough, and that's been a very hard unionizing drive for the IWW. I know that because it's a very big corporation, and they use very intimidating tactics.
Oh,
so yeah,
and just a little more positive news. It looks like there are going to be a couple more stores here in the New York area that are going to be going public as, union stores. So definitely positive news.
So, Buttigieg, if you want, we can go into some today in radical history stuff here.
What happened today? My browser's crapping out on me.
So well, today, 1960, so today is January 4th, 2010 already. The new decade here. So in 1960, exactly 50 years ago, United Steelworkers ended the longest strike in the United States, which began on July 15, 1959. So it lasted about half a year. Doesn't say about what the result of it was, but I'm sure they got something out of it. Back then in the 60s, that's when the unions were a little stronger. They've gone downhill since, unfortunately. And in 1965, right, 1965, let's hope, free speech movement holds first legal rally on Sproul Plaza, University of California at Berkeley. And I know you always like to talk about this, Buttigieg, but that, free speech is not something that was given to us by the founding fathers, is it?
It's unfortunate so many people think that, because that very belief in and of itself kind of gives the idea that these freedoms that we have are gifts from above, right? That these really smart guys we call the founding fathers were like, hey, free speech is cool. Let's make sure everybody can speak and like protest. And, and then it just people's ideas of what free speech is, Yeah, I can't count the many times I've had people say, well, it's cool that we can just sit here and talk. And like, I can say you're an idiot and, nobody's gonna come round me up, and people have no idea the idea behind free speech is to be able to be critical of government, of power, not just be able to call your neighbor a retard or a dumbass or just be able to really criticize and speak out against our government. And those actions that have been repeatedly, not just frowned upon, people and many activists that we hold dear, like Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman and Big Bill Haywood, and it goes on and on and on. I mean, these people, they were round up, put in jail, put in prison, deported from this country for speaking. I always tell people, if you want to talk about free speech, go look at Emma Goldman's arrest record. I mean, the woman wasn't out planting bombs and stuff. She she was arrested time and time again for speaking. That was why she got arrested, And Hoover called her the most dangerous woman, he was seriously scared, because the woman she was awesome, She would tell people here at Union Square during, great economic crisis, hey, go into the stores and take the food. What are you, stand here and starve? Go in there and take it. Direct action, So, they felt she was a real threat, but it was just from speaking. It was just from the power of her ideas and the idea that free speech, it's only come about through people like her, through Freedom Rides, the Wobbly. They would go to these towns. People would just hop on freight cars where they'd have these anti-free speech laws, and they would go, dozens, hundreds of people to these towns until they overfill the jails and keep speaking and speaking and speaking, just to contest those things. That's how we get freedom of speech. You get freedom of speech not by killing people in a third world country, but by speaking,
Right.
by actually contesting power. And, you know, people like Emma Goldman, Wobblies, you know, other members of, you know, the labor movement, the women's rights movement, any you know, civil rights movement. A lot of the main victories for free speech came about through the civil rights movement. But, you know, they definitely have their precedents in other movements. And that's where, you know, that's where our rights come from. I mean, there's all kinds of great stuff on paper. Like, I love, you know, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's a beautiful document. It'd be great if it actually meant something.
Right.
You know?
So,
I mean, even our Constitution would be, you know, great, you know, to some degree if it, you know, they actually paid attention to it.
Well, that's one of the things, actually, I was told at the IWW. They said if you go to Mexico and you read the laws, they have some great labor laws. You know, the workers have all these rights,
yeah.
But... you know, who's enforcing them? You know, if you live in a third world dictatorship of capital, you're not going to be able to enforce those laws. They're just on paper.
We don't even have to go to Mexico to ask who's enforcing our labor laws. I mean, look at all the numerous victories we've had just against Starbucks. I mean, it's really ridiculous because when you win labor like a victory in labor law, a lot of people don't realize this, but like. The what happens to Starbucks is they have to post a bulletin on their wall that says it's almost like it's ridiculous. It's like Bart Simpson writing, "I will not, you know, shoot spit ones." They have to put a little bulletin that says, "I will not, you know, break such and such law again." And and guess what happens if they break that law again? They have to post that bulletin again. Oh my,
right.
You know. I mean that's the you know our labor laws have no teeth. You cannot pay somebody. I mean it's sick.
Right. I mean, labor law says that you can't, you know, fire someone for forming a union, but they do that all the time, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway,
it happens routinely.
All the time. Yeah, there's something being reported over and over again. 1976, so January 4th, 1976 in Spain, the year after Franco died, major wildcat strike wave starts. At its height, over 500,000 workers are involved. And way back, 1849, in Germany, during this month, the anarchist Mikhail Bakunin secretly arrives in Leipzig to prepare for an uprising in Bohemia. In India, 1932, Gandhi arrested for restarting something called Satyagraha campaign. Yeah, this is a big troublemaker, Gandhi. So those are some of the few things that happened today in history. Yeah, is there anything else that called your attention there, that drew your attention?
Oh, about today in history?
Yeah.
No. Like I said, I'm having trouble with my browser,
right.
So I'm not looking at anything. But Joey's in the chat room, and he pointed out that the problem with labor law is the Taft-Hartley Act, and there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, that was a huge slap in the face to labor. But as Susie pointed out, the reality though is that even as bad as the labor laws are, you know, even with Taft-Hartley, they're just not enforced.
But why?
Yeah, they are enforced. Like I said, yeah. Huh?
That's another question people should ask themselves. If Obama is so radical as people thought he was, which now we found out he's not, right? Like, why wasn't the first thing he actually you know did was why didn't he just try to campaign on the repeal of the Taft-Hartley law, the Taft-Hartley Act? He didn't even mention it.
Well, that's just crazy. That's just crazy talk. But I mean, as wonderful as it would be, but he did say he was going to push for EFCA, the Employee Free Choice Act, which you know there's problems with it from a radical perspective. We can go into that, but it would be a step forward in a lot of ways. It would one, it would put some teeth in you know first bargaining agreement, a lot of other things. I'm not going to go into. We don't have a lot of time, but you know he's let that fall by the wayside. That's not going to be passed, and. You know, big labor, you know, and I'm a member of a big labor union as well as IWW, the United Brotherhood of Carpenters. And, you know, we continue to pump this money into the Democratic Party. And it's really sad, you know. I mean, you look at something like EFCA, big labor poured a lot of money into getting Obama elected on this idea that they'd get EFCA passed, and it's dead in the water. It's not going anywhere. And, you know, even the compromise versions of it are just, you know, might as well not even pass it. It's just nothing.
As a side comment, I may say that, you know, I rarely watch TV, rarely watch the corporate media, but the other day I was hanging out at a friend's house and I was watching TV and I sort of forgot how hopeless and how well designed the media can make you, you know, it can really make you feel hopeless. It's designed to sort of make you into a passive consumer and so I would recommend people. I was just reminded of it the other day to not watch TV all that much because it's not. I mean,
Turn it off.
Yeah, because at least on the internet, seriously. You can actually choose what you watch. You know, you want to watch something on YouTube, you go ahead and you are deciding. You know, with the media, it's amazing how. I mean, there's some things that are actually maybe good programs. Some of the programs on TV
Stop it! There's nothing good on.
But by and large,
kidding, folks. There's nothing on TV worth watching.
And talking about movies, there's of course the one we've been talking about the last few days, Avatar, and which does apparently have some good qualities to it, but it also has the sort of standard white hero story about the leader of the indigenous peoples that comes from the white race and stuff like that. Did you actually watch it?
Have you seen it? No, I haven't seen it. I am tempted. It's already made $1 billion, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've already taken the stance that anything that makes $1 billion, I can't watch. So don't know. I mean, everyone's talking about it. I did the same thing with, this is a similar, as far as, you know, amount of money it made. I remember when Titanic came out. Everybody in the world seemed like they saw Titanic. It made $1 zillion when it was out. And I just said, no, I'm not going to go watch it. So, I don't know. I won't go watch it. I'm sure it's, visually it looks amazing. The guy, you know, they spent $500 million making the movie.
Wow.
But I don't know. I'm just someone mentioned what about Jesse Ventura is on TV. You know, Jesse Ventura has a show, and in the next show we do, I'd like to talk a little bit more about conspiracy theory. He has a show about conspiracy theory. Are you familiar with this?
Not really.
Okay, I don't know much about it. Actually, the reason I heard about it was a coworker of mine loves Howard Stern and was listening to Howard Stern. Jesse Ventura came on, and so I accidentally heard Jesse Ventura talking. Apparently, he's got a show where he does a thing on conspiracy theories. I don't want to go into – I don't want to – what I'd like us to do in a future show, not talk about any conspiracy in and of itself, but just to talk about conspiracies – in general, you know, because I think the problem is we often dismiss conspiracy out of hand, and I'd like to talk about conspiracy and class power. I think conspiracies happen. There are well-known ones like the, savings and loan debacle that happened in the mid-80s, the destruction of public transportation in Southern California that was, you know, led by big oil and the big motor companies. There are real examples that we can point to, and so I'd like to talk a little bit about those because we do stress structural analysis, institutional analysis, and things, which are important. But you know, the reality is that you know the elite do have the elite are far more class conscious than we are, than most Americans are. Most Americans, they all think they're part of the middle class. They think we're part of this big happy family. The elite are not that dumb. The elite understand that they're part of a privileged class, and I believe that they look out after their class interests in a way that
90 seconds.
So we have about a minute left, Buddha Jim, and yeah. So in future shows, we'll try to stress the difference between conspiracies and institutional analysis. Yeah. Although sometimes there are real conspiracies, as you point out. So we could end the show here, and I just uploaded a new song, Masters of War, by Bob Dylan, so maybe we could end by playing that. And is there anything else
yeah,
you want to say? you want to say, David, to the our listeners?
Get active. Get out there in the communities. Hit us up. You know, you can reach us on our YouTube channels, on the blog, whatever. You know, if you're in the New York area, San Francisco, Boston, or anywhere else, really, hit us up if you want to get active and get involved, because it's not just about talking.
All right.
Getting out in the communities and doing stuff.
Good night, folks.
Come, masters of war. Here to build the big guns. Here to build the death planes. Here to build all the bombs. Here to hide behind the walls. Here to hide behind discs. I just don't want you to know I can see your nests. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes. And I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled. Fear to bring children into the world. Before threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed, you ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know? But to talk out of turn, you might say that I'm young. You might say I'm unlearned. But there's the one thing I know. I'm younger than you. Even Jesus would never forgive what you do. But let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Or will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. And I hope that you die, and your death will come soon. I follow your casket,